Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to this special Between Takes episode of Missing Frames. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. I recently had the chance to sit down with the producers behind Jim Cummings' new film, The Wolf of Snow Hollow, which, by the way, you can now view on any number of video on demand platforms, iTunes, Amazon, pick one. It's probably there. So go check it out. So today we've got Matt Miller, Natalie Metzger, and Benjamin Wiesner, who are all producers on the film. We talk about all kinds of wonderful things, how the film got started, what it was like working with a big studio, and how Orion and XYZ are so awesome that they prove all those horror stories you've heard about how, oh my god, the studio came in and they destroyed our vision. It's the exact opposite experience here. Orion and XYZ were super supportive. There's even a fun story about how they were kind of in the thick of it with the rest of the production team. We talk about Jim's unique vision, his unique way of working, how on point he is. He's ready, even if there are snags in the production, he's ready to turn around and just make everything work, and how like quick on his feet he is when it comes to decision making. We also talk about what it was like working with the legendary Robert Forster. This was his last feature film. They talk a little bit about that and their friendship with him. We also talk a little bit about their production company, Vanishing Angle, and their unique philosophy as a tight-knit filmmaking family. There are lots of great tidbits here, and hey, if you want to learn more about The Wolf of Snow Hollow and how you can watch it, just head to thewolfofsnowhollow.com. That's that. Let's get to it. Hope you enjoy.
Now available to own on video cassette.
All right. Well, let's start. We'll all introduce ourselves again. We need to make sure the people out there know what we sound like so they can fully enjoy this experience. So Ben, we'll start with you.
My name is Benjamin Wiesner. I'm one of the producers on The Wolf of Snow Hollow.
Hi, I'm Matt Miller. I'm also one of the producers on The Wolf of Snow Hollow.
And I'm Natalie Metzger, and ditto what they said.
Can we take a moment just to bask a little bit in the fact that The Wolf of Snow Hollow just got an endorsement from Joss Whedon? Can we just take a moment? I just want to take some time. I don't know if you guys have properly had the chance to vent the sheer joy, but let's have a moment to focus on that.
You don't even understand. I like saw that tweet and I like started freaking out. I like immediately called Matt over and I'm like, you have to read this, because I mean, everything that Joss has done, like, it's, you know, I'm just such a huge fan of his, and for him to like call the film in that way, and you know, just like giving it such a great review was really awesome.
Apparently we're getting support from Nick Cage too. Apparently he owns multiple werewolf jackets that he's wearing right now in support of the film, so that when people ask him about it, he can then talk about The Wolf of Snow Hollow.
Did he watch it? I know that he was planning on watching it.
I think he's watching this weekend. He's been on set.
I think according to recent reports, he is an actual werewolf, from what I've heard.
I mean, I think the recent reports are that he's a vampire. If you search on the internet, this is a real thing. Search Nicolas Cage vampire, and they'll show you his actual historical photos of people who like are identical to Nick Cage throughout history.
But this has got to be nice, right? I mean, like, the movie's finally out. It took some time. Was it delayed with COVID and everything, or was it always going to be right around this time?
It was delayed several times. We actually initially had, when we started making the film, we were targeting a December 2019 release. And then we all collectively agreed to take a little bit more time in post-production. We did some additional photography, not much, but some stuff that really tied the third act together. And then we had targeted March, and going into March, everybody was like, this doesn't make sense. And we made the call pretty early to sort of make the adjustment to Halloween. And in some ways, it's been really, really lucky for us. I mean, I really feel bad saying it, because COVID has been such a horrible thing for the economy, for the many people who have passed away and families who have had losses. So I never want to make it sound like we benefited off of that. But regardless, we're in this situation where, because we made the film for such an economic cost, unlike other studios, the financial model to release this film right now isn't impacted. You know, so many other horror films that were supposed to come out this season, whether it was Candyman or Halloween 2, like, they've all had to push to next year because they require a certain amount of domestic box office for the math to add up to recoup the value of the film. But because we've sort of always mentally approached film as trying to be efficient as possible and keeping as many dollars on screen, it allowed the film to be made at a price point that, like, it was lower risk for the studio to still commit to this Halloween. And therefore, we're kind of in a landscape without competition. Like, there's, I can't really think of many other horror movies coming out right now, you know, besides maybe Haunting of Bly Manor. Like, I don't really know any other things right now that are making an impact. So we're very lucky. And then on top of that, people have embraced the film. Like you said, Joss and the fans. And as we record this, I think we're 88% of Rotten Tomatoes for critics. So we've just, like, I think it's been a culmination of a lot of luck, and then all the hard work that we did paid off when we got lucky right now.
Natalie, you told me when we first met, I think it had just wrapped back in April 2019, I asked you, I said, can you tell me anything? And you said, quote, "It is a fun ride. It rides that fine line between humor and tragedy. Plus, it's a thriller." And it 100% is all those things. I think it is a blessing in disguise it got moved to this period of time, because, again, it's a horror movie. People are looking for this kind of content. And now you have something that kind of rides the line of all these different genres. But was horror something that, did it feel like a natural extension? Was it something Jim had written already? Like, what was the start of this project? And did it feel, I mean, you look at so many great film directors and they got their start with like a low budget horror movie. Did it feel like the next step for you guys and for Jim to go from Thunder Road to, all right, let's do a horror movie? Or is this something that was in his back pocket?
He had already written it. I think it was 2016, right after the Thunder Road short. It was written before the Thunder Road feature was. So it was playing with a lot of similar thoughts and written at a similar time. But I think just the scope of it was something that we were really excited to see Jim get to play with, that having like much more of this like ensemble cast, having these bigger locations, having these kind of like action sequences, which you'll see like little bits of in Thunder Road, where there's moments where you're like, oh, this is somebody who can really pull that off, but really having that showcase with Wolf of Snow Hollow.
And really, it's a credit to XYZ Films. They, you know, contacted us, as well as tons of other companies, after Thunder Road won the grand jury at South by Southwest. There were just so many companies that wanted to see the film and, you know, were interested in kind of Jim's, you know, what Jim was doing next. And, you know, we weren't sharing links to Thunder Road at the time, so people had to come to our offices to see the film if they wanted to see it. And the XYZ guys came over and they watched it and they loved it. And, you know, XYZ has kind of made such a name for themselves in the genre space. And they asked, they were like, does Jim have anything that's in the genre world? And Jim has, like, you know, always, there's like three or four different feature projects and series stuff that he, you know, that he's juggling with and playing with and in various stages of development. And we're like, well, he actually has this werewolf script. And they're like, great, let's read that. And so they read it and loved it. And they were the ones that helped bring it to MGM and Orion.
This is all your first studio pictures, right?
I mean, it was my second one. We had done something with MGM Orion that was like, it's called a 10 by 10, where you shoot 10 minute episodes and then you cut it into a feature for release internationally. We had done an updated version of Stargate called Stargate Origins that like took one of the characters from the film and told her sort of origin story. It took place in like the 1940s and involved Nazis and the Stargate and things like that. So we had had that experience working with MGM, which I think was a little bit of what made MGM feel confident in this team's ability, besides seeing Jim and Thunder Road, but like the fact that we could sort of, they didn't need to say like, oh, you need to go out and find a sort of production company that can work at this level. They were like, oh, we literally had just worked with them. And so they were like, oh, okay, we kind of saw how that worked. Here's double the budget and, you know, go have fun and report back later.
Well, and Matt hasn't, this was his second time producing, you know, a studio feature, but Matt also has a background as a, you know, as an AD and working in production. And he had worked on a bunch of studio movies back in the day before starting Vanishing Angle, including working on Dark Knight.
Yeah. And so part of the craft of Vanishing Angle, I mean, for listeners who aren't familiar, I'm the president of Vanishing Angle. We're an independent production company. Ben is also, besides a producer on the film, he's our VP of distribution and sales, and Natalie is our VP of production and development. And so Vanishing Angle was sort of crafted out of what I learned working in production on two worlds. Like, I would go and work as a first or second AD on non-union films of like 5 million and under, and then I never joined the DGA, so I would get jobs as like the key set PA on larger studio films. And I worked on you know, The Dark Knight for a few weeks, and I worked on three Clint Eastwood films, and I worked on Into the Wild with Sean Penn, and I worked on Milk with Gus Van Sant, and Greenberg with Noah Baumbach, and so I would like...
Malibu's Most Wanted.
Malibu's Most Wanted.
lead with that, yeah.
I got to lead with that. The first studio film I ever worked on as the Dailies projectionist. But Vanish Angle was really meant to sort of be this hybrid model of like, how do you take independent sensibilities and work at them in the studio system? Like, we were all influenced by those explosions of cinema where that happened. First and foremost, the 70s, obviously. Like, what American Zoetrope was doing in the 70s of like doing things completely independent and then, you know, setting those deals up at studios. And then similarly, that happened when I was in high school in the 90s. I mean, I graduated just at the end of millennium in 2000, and 1999 was that really that explosion of where independent filmmakers had made that crossover into the studio system and took a lot of the sensibilities and ways of making films. And what we were looking at with Vanishing Angle was sort of like that period had lulled for a while. It had completely bifurcated. There was either 100% independent or 100% studio. And like what we've always been trying to grow towards was this model to say like, we can do independent at a studio level. And really The Wolf of Snow Hollow has been our proof of concept for that, of saying like, we can take everything that we did with Jim. We did 10 short films with him as this team. We did a feature film, Thunder Road, with him as this team. Now give us a chance at a studio film, and we can show you we can deliver the same experience on set, the same experience creatively, you know, just at that level that's worth putting ad dollars behind on a studio level. And so that's why we're really excited to see it sort of coming to fruition, is that it's what we've all believed is possible, but now we're actually able to show people like, yes, we can do this. Like, nothing has to change. We can all live at an Airbnb together, and Ben can cook us dinner every night, and we can still make films as a family, but do it with the support of a studio.
And letting them feed each other too. So it's like seeing how studio movies are done and like learning where some of the bloat is from that, and how they can actually learn from how indie films do it. And then also learning like, you know, better systems and like workflows for how the big studios do it, and allowing that to influence the indie films. And so it's like finding the best things from both worlds and like combining them into this kind of hybrid model.
Yeah. I'm not gonna lie, when you said feeding each other, and Matt had just mentioned that Ben cooked dinner, I was thinking that everyone was feeding each other at the Airbnb, and I was like, God, this sounds like a paradise.
That's usually Danny Madden trying to take bites off of everybody's plates.
Danny Madden, who is our creative director, I just had to give context. So for those of you who have listened to previous episodes of this podcast, Ben and I were recently on with Danny Madden, who directed the film Beast Beast, which just played at the Atlanta Film Festival and premiered at Sundance this year. But Danny also is part of this team because he has often been Jim's, what we call a creative director, knowing that Jim's in front of camera so often, having someone that he trusts behind camera to like help check the boxes for Jim that his vision's coming through. And so, yeah, Danny's a integral part of the team, but he also tends to eat off of other people's plates when they're having dinner.
There's like a cliche of working with studios. And I mean, you hear the horror stories of like, oh my gosh, it's a bigger budget, which means it comes with more people on set looking over your shoulder and things like that. With this tight-knit family atmosphere that you guys have developed at Vanishing Angle, was it a little bit weirder, kind of like, all right, well, now we have to kind of invite more people into this family, or was it more collaborative and encouraging?
So we were supposed to have this one scene that takes place at this house in the backyard at this hot tub. And Jim fell in love with this one house that had this beautiful backdrop with this like big mountaintop, but it didn't have a hot tub. And so we had to order in a hot tub and bring it in and get it set up. And we set it up, I think it was like, what was it been like 48 hours in advance, something like that?
It was like 5 or 6 days early.
Yeah. And so like it was supposed to be like, you know, heating up over multiple days to get, you know, all settled and whatnot. But we get there on the morning of, and it was really cold. It was like 50 or 60 degrees. And so throughout the day, we were going to shoot the hot tub scene later. And so throughout the day, we have pots and pans like boiling on the stove inside the house, and we're hand carrying them and dumping them into the hot tub to slowly heat it up. And we got it up to like, it was in the low 80s, which is not warm to like be inside, especially when it's 30 or 40 degrees out and there's snow on the ground. And especially when your talent is in like bikinis and, you know, like swim shorts. So our amazing actors, Jimmy Tatro and Annie Hamilton, were such troopers and were able to be in it and just, you know, embrace that it was going to be a very lukewarm, slightly chilly bath to be in. But the point of the story is we had some of the team from XYZ and some of the team from Orion there with us on the day that day. And they like were in with us helping carry these like pots and pans of boiling water to help fill this hot tub in a very kind of indie family spirit of everyone kind of wearing a bunch of hats and helping out when it's needed. And I think that really is emblematic of what it was like working with Orion, that they were never over our shoulder, you know, kind of telling us what to do. They were very supportive and collaborative and in general, just like kind of trusted Jim. Like, you know, they knew what they were getting. You know, it was like, we are part of this is like a Jim Cummings movie. And so they were very supportive of that. So, you know, like, you know, they visited the set a couple times and were always lovely. And then, yeah, were like helpful during the post-production process with, you know, notes and stuff. But it was honestly like a kind of dream process, like where, you know, you do hear about the horror stories, but we didn't really experience that.
Yeah, and a lot of that's a testament to our two main execs that helped shepherd the project at Orion, which was John Hegeman and Dan Kagan. And they really, when they got involved with Orion, their goal was to support interesting voices like Jim. And so it felt like from that first pitch meeting, which infamously Jim and I were late for because we parked in the wrong parking structure and had to run like 20 blocks in dress shoes and showed up all sweaty and totally nervous. And yet, like, they were so welcoming and they always felt like friends and not foes. And I think you have to remember there's a different set of priorities when working with a studio. There's such a different financial model that's, you know, there's so many more people that are reliant on revenue to feed the machine and pay people's salaries and to make sure that it can all keep going. That's so much different than an independent film, which like really you're focusing on your equity investors and just getting enough back that the artist can keep going, that you have to keep sight of those priorities. And like, we did have hard conversations. That's not to say like there weren't notes and it was all easy. Like, there was definitely disagreements about, you know, how much to show the werewolf, like how much were we delivering on the promise of a horror film for the horror fans, for trailers and posters. Are we really getting it genre enough, but is it also standing up so people understand Jim's, you know, independent artistic sensibility? There was times where we decided to put out multiple pieces of artwork so that like one would appeal to Jim's audiences, one would appeal to the broad horror audiences. And we had to have all those conversations, but I felt like we were all on the same page, that we were talking about the same thing, that like we understood what their priorities are, they understood what ours were, and we were always in respect of each other to get there. And it made for like a really great experience.
Jim strikes me very much, just based on the two features of his I've seen, as a man with a singular vision. And I mean, he's brilliant and it's great. How do you work with that in terms of, as you're developing things, you were talking about like you had to make some evolutions from, all right, is this enough of a horror movie? Is it going to please genre fans? What's that like when you have someone like Jim who is, I think he knows exactly what he wants. And when something contradicts that, if it does butt heads with the powers that be, how do you navigate that? And what was it like just as you were developing the script to try to find those compromises? And like, were there things that he really fought for that ended up in the film, or things that maybe didn't end up in the film that you had to kind of let go of?
Jim just really cares about the audience, I would say. So as long as the idea is coming from like, how are you satisfying the people watching the movie, that it's not a battle. It's like when you get into the wrong discussions, I think, yeah, he's going to feel like, well, this isn't what the movie's supposed to be. But if you're talking really about what the audience is expecting, how to make it more fun, how to make it more surprising, how to do that type of thing, he's so willing to listen to like anybody who has a funnier joke, anybody who has like this little bit of embarrassment, something to make it sadder, all of that type of stuff.
One of the interesting things I've found working with Jim as opposed to other directors is it's not analytical based. It's not like, hey, let's talk about structural beats. Like, hey, we're moving, is this beat fulfilling the move into act two? Or like, you know, have we had the moment where we reached our midpoint in the film? Like all of that to Jimmy is such an inherent sense of it that like, it feels like a waste of energy to sort of talk through that stuff. And to Ben's points, like most of the conversations are really like character oriented. And really understanding how Jim sees the character in his head. I mean, one of the great things Jim does before any of the projects we did with him is that he records the entire script on audio of him reading it. And so he'll read all the parts and he'll drop in some music and some sound effects and, you know, and he'll change the script. So instead of it being like interior police station, he'll be like, John walks into a police station, you know, so that it reads well when you're listening to it. But what that does is it really helps everybody, you know, us as the producers, the cinematographer, the production designer, and even the actors get a chance for the tone and pacing of the film. And a lot of the work's done in that stage. And then the rest of it's just sort of like, it's less of like what you said of like, Jim, what do you think of this? No, it's more, we actually more ask clarifying questions. It's more like, Jim, is your intention in this scene this? And he'll say, oh, it should be about this instead. You know, it's always like trying to pull out of him what he's going for, as opposed to offering up new ideas or challenging the ideas that are there.
And he's like the most, he's like one of the most creative problem solvers I've ever worked with. Like, I think it's why he's like so effective at like also just like doing these incredible shorts that are like low budget, but he's able to knock them out and like really do something special because he's able to adapt so easily and so quickly and so smartly. Like he, if there's a situation where some location falls through or there's something, you know, goes wrong with some light and we have to like look a different way or, you know, something like that. Jim's always like, okay, cool. So if we do it this way, then we can do this, 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 and this. And like already he's able to so quickly adapt and change and figure out a creative solution. And most of the time his creative solutions are like even better than the original one because he's so good at like figuring out things on, you know, on the spot. So I think that's like just like a testament to Jim of he just is such a good creative problem solver. But you're totally right too, like he goes in, like he knows exactly what he wants. So like he goes in with so much preparation, he does tons of rehearsals with himself, and just the process of recording the audio version of the script is like also what like a workshopping of it to figure out the exact pacing and tone. And he's always, you know, like needling with different words or script pieces, but like he can go in and he knows, he's like, I want camera here, I, you know, I want it to be like, you know, moving this way, I want, you know, the blocking to be exactly this. Like he walks in and you actually just have to keep up. And, you know, talking to like the actors or some of the department heads, it's funny because they're just like, yeah, you have to just like go and like be so on top of it because he moves so quickly on the day. Like, you know, we'll all show up to set and he'll just like launch into a full blocking rehearsal and he can read all the parts because he has it all memorized. And so he'll be like, yeah. And then, you know, so-and-so comes over here and they get this line and then he'll give the line like in the exact like way. And then he'll like walk over here and be like, yeah. And the camera's following this way and blah, blah, blah. And like, he knows exactly what he wants. So like, that's the beauty of Jim is that he can come in so prepared and know exactly what he wants and he can do all of that. And then you can say, oh, Jim, we actually can't shoot this way because it's doing this thing. He's like, oh, okay, cool. So this way. Okay, so then, and then he can just like launch into it again. Like it's pretty incredible.
There's something interesting in this movie. Thunder Road, his character is extremely empathetic and we're seeing this guy in some really pathetic situations. And yet I always felt, I was so amazed that you could empathize with him regardless. And in Wolf of Snow Hollow, it felt like he was taking a bit more of a risk with his character. I can't remember his character's name because I'm a terrible person. But there's almost a nastiness and an edge that when people give kind of dismissive criticisms of this film and they're like, oh, it's Thunder Road with a werewolf. I'm like, well, clearly you didn't watch the movie because this is not that movie. And a lot of that has to do with his character. What is the conversation like trying to find that balance when you have a character who is kind of more evidently unlikable and is more kind of pushing the boundaries of like, dude, I don't know how I feel about this guy. What are you looking for to kind of ensure that you're not losing people who are watching and engaging with the film?
I think it's trusting what part of the film that character is in. John, we didn't name him Jim for once. John is not as lovable and as instantly redeemable as Jim's character in Thunder Road, but also he is supposed to be mirroring the arc of the story and the arc of this falling apart. And the idea of this werewolf, it comes from this idea that's a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a werewolf is a term for somebody who is relapsing, but they're still in the program because they're a danger to everyone around them as well. So you can't give John the redeeming qualities that we need Jim and Thunder Road to have. The film's not about the same things. It's not a character study in the same way. It's about what this is doing inside this small town. So he has a role to play in that, and it's not as lovable of a role, but I think it's important. Like, there wasn't as much of that, like, oh, how do we soften him, or how do we do this, or how do we do that? It was much more about making sure that we weren't getting to that point too early.
And one of the things we're excited about is the evolution of these ideas that Jim's exploring in his next film, The Beta Test, that we shot last November, that Jim's doing finishing touches on right now, is sort of an even further evolution of this idea of sort of, you know, the anti-hero as used to explore sort of like toxic masculinity, really. And The Beta Test goes even further by, instead of being a cop, being a Hollywood agent, which is right off the bat a little easier to dislike. So that's why I think we're really also excited about, you know, I was saying earlier, we're excited that this sort of proof of concept is paying off with audiences and they're responding to it, but also in the creative direction that Jim's been growing with ever since, you know, some of the shorts we did with them, and then Thunder Road the feature, and now this, and then with The Beta Test, like we feel just really confident that audiences are gonna see what he's going for in The Beta Test and really embrace it. So that's like sort of what we're looking to as a future as being excited about.
There was something else in the movie that I thought was interesting. Again, as a father figure, he's trying to live up to his own father. He's doing so at the expense of being a father. And he's not there for his daughter. He's kind of absent emotionally, just like not there. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Robert Forster, who I first saw, as I'm sure many of us out there did, in Jackie Brown, and was just blown away by him in that. And then, of course, a couple years ago as a David Lynch fan, to see him in Twin Peaks was just a huge joy. And then to hear that he was going to be in this film, I mean, what an incredible actor, and what an amazing opportunity to have gotten to work with him. And I think, I mean, this was his last feature, correct?
It was, yeah.
Wow. He strikes me as such just a joy, like just a joy of a human being. Because every time he's on screen, it's, you immediately are like, oh, thank God he's here. I feel better already.
To take it back, I mean, I met Robert when we were, I co-produced, and then we eventually distributed a film called Too Late, directed by Dennis Houck, that we were doing in 5 22-minute takes on 35mm. It's this like detective film noir that you should definitely check out. It's on Amazon Prime. It stars John Hawks. And Robert came on to one of our segments like days before shooting. I mean, it was really like one of the last casting pieces. And he had to learn a 22-minute scene that he had to perform within a few days. And he was incredible. Like, and he was just so gracious as a human being. And he carries a sense of integrity with him that maybe used to be present in old school Hollywood and now is missing currently. Just something about him. Like, he just feels so unique and different than anybody else you're with on set. Really professional, really there. He's always said it. He said it on that film, and he said it to Jim when he first met with Jim on this film, is that like, he's there in service of the director. Like, he wants Jim to tell him, you know, where to go, what to do. And he knows that's what he's there for. And he brings his A game every time. And so when this film came around, we were trying to figure out somebody that could sort of, you know, not only live up to playing Jim's father for us, also because we all are close with Jim's actual father, and who's just a larger than life, amazing human being himself, but also like the weight of that character in the script of The Wolf of Snow Hollow has a certain dynamic to it. Like, it needs to feel like these shoes that need to be filled by John. And that's the weight that adds to his alcoholism, is like trying to live up to that. And there's so few people that just have that presence immediately on screen for people. And Robert Forster came to mind. And I mean, I texted him to see if he'd be interested. And he got back within like 20 minutes and then was on the phone with me within 30 minutes. You know, I talked to him about Jim. We sent him Thunder Road. He talked his agents into it. His agents and managers were sort of like, really, do you want to be doing this werewolf film? We're not quite sure. He basically told them like, listen, I see what this kid's doing. He's a triple threat. Writer, director, everything. He's like, this is the type of person that we need to be supporting in this industry. And came out into the middle of nowhere, Utah, and was just such an incredible person to be around. I mean, we were devastated when we found out. Natalie and I were actually watching a cut of the film in our screening room when we got the text about it. And it was a year ago, Sunday, as we're recording this, October 11th. And it was heartbreaking. I mean, it was such a loss. Personally, like, I'd become close with Robert. When we distributed Too Late, we were doing a lot of Q&As, and he actually lived near the Sunset Five in West Hollywood, which is where we played Too Late. So he would come to like almost every showing and hang out and do Q&As. And Yeah, I mean, I'm going to miss him tremendously as a human being. He brought so much to this film and so much integrity. And watching the film is heartbreaking because there's so many parallels. We don't want to ruin the film for anybody, but it's still difficult for me to watch. And I actually still get kind of emotional watching certain scenes with Robert right now.
Yeah, he was such a gentleman and just such a sweetheart. He gave like a lot of the team, he gives, I actually have it here. He gives these like letter openers as gifts. And anyone who's like worked with him has gotten one of these. And he's just like so thoughtful and sweet and just such an incredible actor. Like he really, all of his scenes were, we were kind of all blown away just like watching him work. Cause he has such an intuitive feeling for like characters and how to read them and how to work with other people. I had the joy of driving him back and forth between where we were shooting, which was like an hour outside of Salt Lake City, driving him back and forth to the airport. And it was just so nice getting to know him on those long drives. And yeah, it was very, very emotional watching it. The first time that we watched the film after he passed was like a really emotional experience.
And then talking about just in terms of toxic masculinity, which there is, I do, what a weird transition. The exact opposite of toxic masculinity is Robert Forster. So sorry, audience. That was on me. I did a terrible job transitioning. But I wanted to talk a bit about Ricky Lindholm. She, in some ways, is the film's hero. And the commentary is in there. It's not so overt, but there's a lot of fun stuff. There's an exchange where John is talking with her character, Julia, about women have had to deal with this for so long, and the look on her face is just spot on. But what was it like working with her, developing that character? And again, she's a very quiet presence, and then you quickly start to realize, like, oh, she might be the only one who knows what she's doing. So a little bit about that, like how that speaks to sort of the themes of toxic masculinity, just kind of this patriarchy of like these, those very male dominated job roles.
Now his favorite line.
It is. I love that line. I would like burst out laughing every single time that like that happened. But yeah, she's like the real hero of the film. And Ricky is just so incredible. I mean, I was always familiar with her comedy work, and then seeing her just kick ass in this, like, I mean, it's a very dramatic role. I mean, there are elements of it that are very funny, but like not played as comedy necessarily. Like, you know, she really plays kind of the straight man to everyone else's chaos. And she's such an incredible dramatic actress as well. And I don't think, you know, many people have gotten the opportunity to see her as that, but she is such a sweetheart and like kind of so down to do it. I mean, similarly, Matt can tell the story, but you know, she had worked with Matt before and kind of hopped on.
Yeah, I mean, she was in our first film we ever made our feature we made as a company called The Dramatics of Comedy. And she was friends with the writer-director of that, Scott Rogers. And he brought her in from the UCB world. And I hadn't known her at the time. Like, I don't even think I had known Garfunkel and Oates yet. And it wasn't until we cast her that I started watching their videos and like totally fell in love with the comedy duo. And any of your listeners who have not checked out Garfunkel and Oates absolutely need to. It's amazing. It's like the, you know, I hate saying this, it's like, because I don't want to compare them to somebody else, but like, they should be as popular as Flight of the Conchords. I guess I'll put it that way.
They're the hyper-feminist version of Flight of the Conchords.
But, you know, and I had such a great experience working with her on that film. When we were coming down to casting this role, I don't know what it was. There was just something about it that it felt like the right way to offset. Like, Jim had sort of pitched the character as like, he had sort of referenced Holly Hunter. And there's like a levity to Holly Hunter that I think of when I think of the characters that she played, that I knew that Ricky could bring that levity and that seriousness. And so Jim's only thing he said was like, well, can she have darker hair? And we're like, well, she can dye it. And he's like, great, that I love her, you know? And she just totally nailed it. Like, I think we hit her at the right timing where she was in between different projects. And, you know, similarly to Robert, it was like a very quick turnaround between when we cast her and how to come out. And I guess I should explain, like, these sort of quick turnarounds, part of that is it's a little bit how we've pulled films together in the past, that like they tend to come together very quickly. We tend to make film, like the traditional Hollywood model is a little bit more of like, attach actors, use those actors to go out and get financing, then use that financing to make the movie, where we've done it successfully a little bit backwards, where like we back a great writer director with a vision that sort of pulls the film together financing wise and otherwise. And then we like get a date on the calendar. And once that date's on the calendar, we all just start marching towards it. And so some of these elements, especially casting, can come together very quick in those final moments. And so a lot of the cast, like Jim had written the film around and for, you know, like Hannah Elder, who's one of the victims, Jim's known her since college and she was always going to play that part, you know, like parts written for Will Madden or parts written for Kevin Shangaris or Skylar Bible, like some of those, like, Annie Hamilton, like always knew it was going to be Annie, you know? But some of these other roles, like it was definitely filling in last minute. Cause you know, we were also again working with a studio and we had to provide a certain profile that fit their financial models. So like someone like Robert and someone like Ricky, who had a track record with a fan base, but you know, to their credit, both to Ricky and Robert's, like just really would, like came in, were willing to do this weird winter summer camp with us where we, again, like we all lived at an Airbnb together. Like Ricky lived at a house with Chloe East, who plays Jim's daughter in the film. And, you know, like they would have dinner every night together and hang out. And like, she was just so down for that from the beginning. And it's also because she's a writer director herself and she's a creative. So she knew what we were going through. And it was just sort of like-minded people finding each other at the right time. And it worked out really well.
And one of the reasons why we kind of like that idea of casting much closer to the date is that you do have the opportunity to work with people like Ricky and like Robert, who are so successful, but they can look at their calendar and actually say yes, rather than being 2 years out and not knowing about this TV show or that thing or what could be happening otherwise. It's a much easier thing for them to evaluate of like, do I want to be a part of this film because it's happening now?
Do you, like, in the midst of all of this and as we're finally seeing the film and it's finally coming out, do you get to take a break and enjoy this at least? Because you guys, yeah. I will give you permission to take a breather if you need to and enjoy the success of at least one or two films that you've released.
We got a great drive-in premiere at Beyond Fest that we all went out to and got to see a movie on a drive-in. And then the actual opening night of the film last Friday, the 9th, we celebrated by watching other horror movies. We watched Halloween and Scream back-to-back. That was our celebration.
But we have 6 projects in post, so we're staying busy.
Yeah, it's a little bit nonstop for us. I mean, I miss the days where it was just sort of one project at a time, but yeah, I mean, no, we don't get a chance to sort of like pop the champagne and spend a night getting drunk and a morning being hungover. It's sort of like pop the champagne, have a quick glass, and then right back to marketing or, you know, budget for another film or post notes on this film or whatever it is.
But it takes so long in this industry to actually get busy that it's my favorite way to celebrate. You know, it's that model where it's like, okay, Thunder Road just won this big award at South by Southwest, and this short just won a couple of awards at South by Southwest as well. Like, let's get behind that short. Let's launch a Kickstarter tonight. Let's stay up the whole time. And that's how we get Beast to come out next. Like, it's kind of taking every little bit of success as the momentum that you can turn it into instead of an achievement on its own.
And I think really, like, for you to be talking to this team is part of what makes that work so well, is that, like, there are 3 of us to sort of, at any one time, be attacking things from different points of view, and we're all really on the same page almost all the time. And there's even more beyond these 3. Like, we just happen to really be the main 3 behind a lot of Jim's work. But, like, even when a couple summers ago, when Beast was greenlit, Greener Grass was greenlit at the same time. And like Natalie went and did Greener Grass in the same city, Peachtree City in Georgia, that Ben was producing Beast on the ground. And then I was back in LA prepping the release of Thunder Road theatrically. So like we can divide and conquer when need. And then we can also come together and do a project like The Wolf of Snow Hollow. And like I think that's a lot more of a unique situation than other people have. And like, for us to carry the titles, like, of also me being president and Ben being VP of development and sales and Natalie being VP of production development, like, we are also doing those duties as well. Like, Ben is also helping to handle the foreign sales on multiple projects right now, including whatever he can do to help support what MGM's doing foreign-wise for The Wolf of Snow Hollow. And, like, Natalie is actively you know, reading new content and developing new projects to be going up on our slate next. You know, like we're prepping a film to shoot, you know, early next year that, you know, Natalie's constantly sending cast offers out for and building budgets for and schedules for. And so like part of it's that we wear a lot of hats and we just all work well together and we see the world the same way.
You talk about how, I mean, this film was uniquely poised to kind of work with all the craziness going on in the world. The release worked and you saw success with that with Thunder Road, which got like a kind of a limited international release, right? Okay. So it's kind of like we're living in this world where Natalie, when we last spoke, we were talking about like, oh, hopefully everyone's waiting to see how Tenet does. Is he going to save cinema? Is he going to save movie going? And Tenet came out and obviously that didn't happen. And now we're seeing a lot of the big films kind of, all right, well, we'll see you next year. Films that were slated for the end of this year. But Vanishing Angle, you guys have a really, really unique position in that you've seen success not only with Thunder Road, but now with Wolf of Snow Hollow, amongst other things. Are you worried about like what's going on right now? Do you feel like, well, we can still make movies? I mean, maybe that's a loaded question, but are you able to keep going? And even without like wide theatrical releases, do you think that this has kind of put you in a unique position to almost thrive in that particular kind of landscape?
I mean, I think for us, we're, in terms of the release side, just trying to be really careful and really respectful. We were supposed to be theatrical only. And one of the reasons why we made that decision with MGM is I remember this spring talking to some people who run venues. And one of them was an Alamo Drafthouse manager. And he said, the thing that I can't figure out is how do I only offer these opportunities to people who are going out, that are putting themselves possibly in the way of the coronavirus. And so I really feel passionately about like, we should be offering similar opportunities at home right now. We should incentivize what your entertainment options can be at home throughout this and not just say, you can only have cool new stuff if you're going out. I think there's other ways to support. There's other ways to be community. And we're passionate about finding that. I mean, absolutely, we want to be in theaters. And theaters have been such an important part of the success of something like Thunder Road, where we're able to go around the country. I saw that film in over 40 different states with audiences. And so when we release online, there's people in 40 different states who care, because they've seen it with us, they've met us, they probably had quite a few beers with us. But those are the people who are going to be super fans. Those are the people who are going to follow you forever. Those are the people who are going to end up giving $500 to your crowd equity campaign a year and a half later. And that's the reason why you're able to make the beta test. It's this thing where you keep stacking these different experiences and you're building real relationships, and theaters are a part of that. But I also care about those people and I want them to be able to see the film however they feel comfortable. It's a really weird thing. I've never been in a position where we're releasing a film and I've never seen it with an audience. So that's an incredibly strange feeling, like not knowing where everybody laughs, where everybody cries, where all of those things happen. But I mean, it's just, there's nothing else you can do except for take this really seriously and be as caring and as careful as you can.
And in terms of the shifts of the industry you're talking about, Sean, is like, I think we've all known these were coming. I look at Corona more as an accelerant than it is something that's actually changed anything. It's made things that were going to change already happen much quicker. And when we started Vanishing Angle, we started it at the advent of streaming. I think we started the company in 2010. And I think that was the same year that Netflix started appearing on Roku. And, you know, it was when YouTube started to explode as a real means for people to put content out there. Like, we've always understood that we can't be a company that sets roots in the grounds, because like the ground's always going to shift and we always need to be able to pivot and we always need to be able to look at things differently. And it's all about mitigation of risk. And the way that like other companies do that, and especially the studios, is like they do that by casting big names and paying them millions of dollars to be like, well, you know, if Tom Cruise is in this movie, it can't fail. But then you have The Mummy and it fails, you know, like, and we've always looked at it differently, which is that focus on story first, focus on the storyteller first, and pivot around that. And if you can keep things economic, and that's not to say it has to be low budget, you know, like we can do studio level projects, we can scale up, but there's a way to keep them economically efficient and cut out that fluff, the fluff of paying an actor $30 million that goes on top of the budget, things like that, that make it so that you can pivot in unpredictable conditions. You know, like I said at the beginning of this podcast, so many other people had to pull their releases off the calendar or have had, you know, we just read in the news that Coming to America, Paramount sold it to Netflix because they couldn't figure out a model for it. And that's the only financial way they could go. But if you're able to sort of be smart about the building of the product, the building of the film in a way that is financially, you know, viable under many conditions, then you can pivot easily. And like Ben said, like we were originally going to be wide release on this film, but when the time came, we were like, that doesn't make sense. Like let's pivot to a new way to do it. And it actually put us in the best position possible because now we're the only horror film out during Halloween.
What do you think is unique to this experience? I mean, just the thought of the Airbnb and the family environment and things like that sounds like so much fun. Is that something that is the norm? Is that something you're going to carry on with future productions? What kind of things from this production in particular are you going to use moving forward?
We've always tried to create a like family atmosphere on, you know, on our sets. And that goes back to creating, you know, our focus is long-term relationships with both cast and crew. We love supporting people and we love making movies and we like finding people that are similarly minded. And so we try to create a culture on set that's full of gratitude and full of creativity and support where people, you know, if someone needs help with something, you know, we're all like jumping in to help and, you know, and figure it out. And it's just a very collaborative atmosphere. And so something that we want to continue maintaining for, you know, for all projects. And, you know, even on this project that we just wrapped earlier this year that we did with Ubisoft, like Matt, Ben and I stayed.
Another werewolf movie. Is this making everyone, are you guys like, oh no, that's happening. We've become the werewolf.
Yeah, we do not want to be pigeonholed as just werewolf producers.
Especially winter werewolf producers. That's unacceptable. We can get Werewolf Beach.
Yeah, if someone wants to write a werewolf movie that takes place in Hawaii, we will look at it. but yeah, I mean, for that movie, we were shooting in upstate New York and Matt, Ben and I were all staying at this like the main location. And you know, people, you know, some of like our rooms are being used as actual sets. And so like, you know, you would show up at night and, you know, the furniture would be moved around or something would be added, you know, cause they were, you know, set decking it or, you know, like Matt's room was used for like actor holding. So his mattress was always being like pushed up into a wall and.
Yeah, we were doing okay. Ben's room was being used for art storage, which was probably the worst of it. And then eventually when they took the doors off of Natalie's bedroom and bathroom, that's when Natalie was like, okay, I got to move to a motel for a few nights.
Understandable.
Yeah, they're like, it's okay for us to take the door off, right? And I'm like, yes, but let me find a different spot. But yeah, I mean, that's just, I think we're on the ground producers and like, and the entire idea is to get the job done and to like put as many resources as you can in front of camera. And so that's like, you know, what we want to continue doing. And I think that's how we want to be able to use some of those things from that indie mindset and bring them to studio movies so that you're able to achieve even, you know, even more with the resources that you're given.
Well, I'll say the one thing, I actually do want to give this shout out for anybody in the industry who's listening to this. We worked really hard to have limited hours on this film. We were shooting outside of Salt Lake City and like we've relatively done that unspoken on many of our films. Like that first film I worked on with Ricky, I mentioned to you, like we wrapped all those in like 10 hours. Thunder Road, I think most of our days were like 10 hour, 11 hour days, but it was never a sort of like mandate. We never walked in and we were like, we have to have like a 10 or 11 hour day. But when we were shooting outside Salt Lake City and we knew a lot of our crew would be commuting, we very deliberately sat down and we were like, we will not shoot more than 11 hours. Like from the time the crew arrives on set to the time they leave needs to be an 11 hour day because we need to compensate for that fact that they're driving back and forth. And a lot of the crew both applauded us in the beginning for saying that, but also didn't believe we would do it. And we did it. I mean, like, I think there was really only one day that we had longer overtime, which everybody sort of understood the reasons for that day. And I think almost every other day, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure any crew listening to this will, after listening to this podcast if I was wrong. But we did a really good job doing that. And I think we proved to ourselves that, like, even with a larger crew, not everybody was part of the family that we had done those 11 other projects with. We were hiring other locals. But, like, even with a new crew, like, we could still get that done. And, like, that's a big priority for us industry-wide, is getting back to, like, I mean, we really think it should be a 10-hour day or an 8-hour day, and that this, like, standard 12-hour day is just absurd. It doesn't breed good work, especially over feature projects that are over multiple days and weeks and months. And so, like, that's something that I would take away from this film and really continue to push on other films and continue to push other people. And it has to start from the producers and the director. Like, it has to start from that group saying, we're committed to this, you know, we're going to make the days work for this. And then, you know, and then it can flow down from there.
All of those crew members are people who are out there 200 days a year on set. It's different for us. Like, we're going home and we're obviously going to keep working and everything like that, but we're hoping to do 2 movies a year. That's so different than most of the people who are hired. They're going to be working something the day after, or they're working on their off days on this project as well. Like, those people are so constantly on set that I really do think it's up to decision makers to just create a better way of treating everyone. And again, that goes into, like, the gratitude and all of these different parts of it that we've been talking about. Like, you have to not just say thank you, but you have to show that they're really valued and you want to put them in the best position to really succeed and to put their best foot forward.
Well, I love that philosophy. You know, it's as exciting as it is for you to hear these great things and to read Joss Whedon's tweet and to see 88% of Rotten Tomatoes. As a fan of what everyone in this conversation is doing, it's really exciting because that means I get to see more from you guys. And I can't wait to see the beta test. We'll regroup in a few months. Always a pleasure to chat with you. Congratulations on all the success.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.